Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 565. Today is Friday, August 29th. I'm going to be performing just outside of Detroit tonight, and then tomorrow Pittsburgh, and then Sunday just outside of Chicago for the Oddball Comedy Fest. Oddballfest.com for tickets. Folks like Sarah Silverman and Bill Burr and me and Hannibal Buress. And it's fun. It's a good tour. You should come out. Venues are big. The venues are real big. Almost scarily big. But fun. Maybe I should crowd surf to the back of an amphitheater. Nah, someone would drop me because they'd think it was funny. And it would be funny. So that's why I won't let that, happen. Hey, we just launched a new podcast, the official Sleepy Hollow podcast called Sleepycast, hosted by Clark Wolf. The first episode just came out. Orlando Jones is on it, the executive producer is on it, showrunner. And we're going to be putting new episodes of that up every Tuesday. So if you're a Sleepy Hollow fan, then you should probably listen to Sleepycast. Or if not, listen to it anyway and then watch the show, huh? Go in the back door, do the old podcast back door in a TV show. Why don't you? This episode is the Dowdle brothers, who directed the film As Above, So Below, which comes out today, Friday, August 29th. John Eric and Drew Dowdle, and super nice guys who've directed some other horror movies like Quarantine and Devil. So this movie comes out today, and here's the podcast for it. I'm talking really fast because I have to get to the show tonight. It's, the travel schedule is a bit of a neck breaker. Although, I did, not that you asked, but I did sleep a lot more last night than I had in a really long time. I had a week of, like, 4-hour nap bonanza, basically, is what it felt like, as opposed to getting sleep. My sleep schedule felt like naps. So I'm back on now. And here you go, the Nerdist Podcast number 565 with the Dowdle brothers.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Welcome to the podcast. Are you guys on? Are you on a crazy? Oh, are these my glasses or are those yours?
These are mine.
Do you have the same ones?
Similar glasses.
They're good ones, huh?
These. I don't have glasses like yours.
I know.
Get out.
I'm not quite as snazzy as you two. Drew's dating a costume designer, and he's very snazzy.
She was not responsible for my glasses.
No, no, you can, be honest about it. It's fine. Give her some.
I can make some good decisions on my own.
No, you can't. You have to. No,
that's true. Drew's snazzy. In all fairness, he was snazzy before she showed up. Yeah.
Are you on a whirlwind press tour at the moment?
We are.
Yeah,
kind of,
a little bit.
It's been active. We were in Paris. We did a lot of it in the catacombs in Paris, which was fun.
It must be nice to travel with your brother.
Yeah,
it's really great. It's nice doing all of this.
Were you being sarcastic right now?
No.
I'm totally kidding. But it'd be like, it's really great. Yeah. I can't fucking take another minute of this.
Wait for this to be over.
Do we have to work together and travel together? I had to grow up with you? I was going to stick your face.
No, we took a vacation, the week before last? We took a vacation apart from each other for a week, which was... which we rarely do. It's like we're kind of together 24/7.
It feels weird.
It does feel weird.
You know,
it's maybe necessary once a year to spend a week apart.
So how do you work in terms of if you're I flip flop and I think, oh, it'd be great, like having a brother to work with could either be amazing or it could just be a huge pain in the ass, because then if you start arguing about something work-related, it can very quickly devolve into something that's very personal. And how do you keep the lines separate?
I think we try very hard not to do that, you know. And, I think typically, like, if we're not getting along, I usually feel like, okay, I'm anxious or I'm worked up about something stupid.
Yeah, there's a reason for it. I mean, in filmmaking, you have to have partners. I mean, it's a very hard thing to do in a vacuum, I think. Having a partner that you're related to, I mean, we can read each other's minds most of the time, so it's very convenient.
Yeah, often we'll both respond to an email with the exact same words, like top to bottom, and send it out at the exact same moment.
But you're not twins.
No, very much not.
But you have the twin connection somehow. I thought that was only the creepy twin bond.
No, we've had a couple like moments of like true twin bond.
Yeah.
And,
if Drew burns his arm, do you go, my arm, somewhere in another part of the...
You know, it's funny. He almost got in a car accident once, and I was taking a nap in the middle of the day in Los Angeles, and he was in Minnesota, and I woke up like terrified, like something just happened to Drew. And I called and left a message like... He, you know, spun out on the freeway and just missed like two other cars, and I called him like a minute later.
You either sensed it or you caused it. You know that, right?
That never occurred to me. I like the idea that I caused it. Here's my dream, my powerful dream.
You know, I think that would actually make a really interesting story. Based on the old, like the Time Life book series, like Mysteries of the Unknown, where it's like a woman is asleep in one and 2,000 miles across her sister, and she senses... That it'd be really interesting if two siblings discovered that they had this kind of like weird connection, and that it was almost like a parasitic connection, and one could absorb the other's like psychic energy, and then all of a sudden they basically just start like this, and their relationship begins great, but then they just start it's just this tug of war of who's ultimately, and then it kind of turns into like a. Think of like a Road Trip meets Scanners. All right, does that work? Does that work somewhere?
I love that.
For you guys? Should we pitch that? Okay. Someone write that down. Road Trip meets. Don't actually write that down, Kyle. All right. Is Michael Ironside still alive?
I'm pretty sure.
Okay, good. We'll get him. Minnesota, by the way. Are you from Minneapolis?
St. Paul.
You're from St. Paul.
Sort of same diff.
Yeah, kind of the same diff. In Minnesota, they...
If I were to say, like, oh, same thing, people are like, hey, you watch your fucking mouth.
In Minnesota, they would, yeah.
Yeah. Because I know they're not the same at all. I think Minneapolis, St. Paul, I think that whole area is fucking amazing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, yeah.
We love
it. It's such a... I imagine there's probably a hotbed of creative activity because it's too fucking cold to do anything else for a large...
That's exactly right. We always say that, too. There's, people are just cooped up for so much of the year that, you know, it breeds a lot of creativity.
It breeds a lot of weirdos.
Weirdos,
you know,
too, yeah.
Like, you know, you got the Coen brothers, you have Bob Dylan, you have Prince.
Terry Gilliam.
Yeah. You know, you have a lot of these really weird...
Neil Gaiman.
Who's that?
Neil Gaiman lives in Minnesota. He's obviously not from... He's not American, but Neil Gaiman lives in Minnesota.
Cool.
So it's a good... I don't know if I could take an 8-month winter.
No, it's awful.
No.
There's a reason we live here now. We love it there. We love to visit, but it's nuts.
Yeah, so what's the what is the film scene like in Minneapolis at the moment?
It used to be a lot stronger. It's coming back. It had a big lull here. It had some tax incentive issues where other states were just so much more, you know, advantageous to shoot in. So it had nothing going on for a while, but it's coming back.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
do you guys shoot there?
No.
We never shot there.
No, we shot As Above in Paris. We shot The Coup in Thailand. We shot in
Toronto and
shoot
LA.
All over the place.
So there are not catacombs under Minneapolis? Am I understanding this? You know, let's do that.
That'd be pretty amazing.
Did they let you shoot in the catacombs?
Yeah, in the real
thing. They did, yeah.
Yeah. We pushed and pushed, and we refused to have a backup plan, and we just kept beating the drum like, it needs to be the real thing. You know, we don't want to build this. You know, you can't fake something that historic. And
you're not going to go to Paris and then build the catacombs on a stage. That seemed ridiculous. But
that seems like that's a double waste of money.
Yeah.
Getting everyone to Paris and then renting a stage. Yeah. You could just do that here where we are right now.
Exactly.
You could just put a bunch of skulls in this hallway.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, the French were kind to us. They let us... I mean, the bureaucracy of Paris didn't exactly move very fast, but we ultimately got the permissions we needed.
Mm-hmm.
How sanctioned is running around the catacombs? Is it not allowed at all?
No, it's illegal. There's the public like tour of the catacombs, and then everything else is sort of illegal. And so, yeah, we shot in both sections, and neither of them had ever had a film shoot there before. So we shot in the public and in the, you know, we went through like, at one point we went through like a hole like this big and like underground and
how deep does it go?
Like
6 or 8 stories in some parts.
So
most of what we shot was 6 stories underground.
Yeah.
So it was,
we brought a piano down there. We brought like, okay. I mean, we did all kinds of crazy shit down there and Yeah, there's no bathrooms. There was no, you know, there's nothing, no electricity, you know.
No, you just have to pee on some poor old French dead guy.
Exactly. And
you have to soil everything that he was with your waste.
The Parisian government let us shoot this, the off-limits section of the catacombs, which is illegal. They finally gave us permission, but they said we couldn't show how you get in because they didn't want us to, you know, spark any additional people going to check it out. So we went to basically the location you get in, and we, you know, dug a hole 100 feet away from where the real hole is, and we went in there on the same train track, so it's essentially the same exact spot, but 30 feet away, and this, and that worked for them.
What was the creepiest thing you saw?
You know, I think that first time going through the hole in this train bridge, and then, you know, you're underground, and, you know, like crawling on all fours, and then you're in water up to your chest, and like that for me, like, that really freaked me out, you know, to be submerged in water with, like, you know, maybe a foot and a half, 2 feet of air, like, above your head.
Oh,
like,
no, that does not sound...
Yeah, that wasn't cool. I was like, this isn't okay.
This is really clean water, right?
It is, actually. Like, you would think it was disgusting, but, you know, it was actually, you know, it was rainwater. It was totally clear, like glass, and, you know, once you started stepping in it, then it would kick up dirt, but, you know, it was actually, I think it was quite clear.
Yeah, we shot in another section, too, where these monks were cloistered back in like the 15th century for their whole lives. They would live down there, and they still keep these like mannequins and, you know, monk robes kind of always lurking behind corners. So when you'd walk through the dark and you'd walk past one, it would always appear as if it's jumping out at
you. It was just that, the stuff's just down
it's
there.
It's just down there. Yeah.
So there's all sorts of artifacts that they can't, I guess would get super arrested if you tried to take anything from the catacombs. Yeah.
People do though. People go on the public tour and, you know, walk out with a femur. Or a skull, you know. People do it all the time.
Is it that it's unsafe? Why do they not let people go further down?
I think they just, you know, there's kind of this like underground cataphile, you know, world, and they, you know, they have raves down there. They have a cinema down there that sort of moves around and disappears, and then the cops come down, and, you know, I think the people are dangerous maybe to themselves down there more than the spaces, you know.
It's really easy to get lost in there too. I mean, if you're not with someone who really knows it, so I'm sure a lot of teenagers go down there without anyone who really knows where they're going and, you know, need to be rescued.
Your skyways in Minneapolis are very similar to the catacombs.
We've always wanted to use the skyways.
Line them with skulls.
Yeah. you can't give me the sequel.
As above, so above. Minneapolis.
Keep coming across really nice bums, you know.
It's just all the weird, like, advert billboards. I'm so delighted by the Skyway system. Is it called?
Yes, Skyway. Yeah, Skyway. Yeah.
I mean, the idea that you could get from one section of downtown to another section of downtown and just be indoors. There's something really charming about that to me, and kind of cozy.
There is.
It's kind of amazing. I worked actually in downtown Minneapolis my first year after college, and I could pull right into my underground garage at my office and not even wear a coat, and, you know, get anywhere downtown. And I mean, people would go for weeks at a time without stepping outside.
There's a giant adult store downtown, and I can't remember what it's called.
Shinders?
Shinders was one.
It's one where I went inside and there was a giant... Well, it's either Shinders or O'Flaherty's or it's the Puss Cave or, well, there's Tiddlywinks and then there's also Peekaboobs. God, I don't know. I mean, those are the first nine off the top of my head. But the one that I went into was... There was a giant dick that had a saddle on it, and you could get your picture taken on this rodeo dick. Basically, I don't know what else to call it.
That's amazing.
But it was enormous. Like the store was enormous, and it was really fun. It's also really fun to go into a place like that, and you walk in, and you're riding on the dick, and someone's like, "Hey, are you Chris Hardwick?" Like, "Oh, yes, I seem to be." And here I am riding a giant dick.
It's probably harder for you to ride the giant dick than us. Yeah.
Thank you for watching. Please don't watch now. So when did you guys get out? When did you escape St. Paul?
Gosh, 95. I went to NYU and then I moved out here after that. So
yeah, I went back for 1 year after college, then moved to New York. So for me, it was 98.
What were your horror films growing up?
The Shining. The Shining was my very favorite.
Yeah, The Omen was probably my favorite growing up, too. I just, something about Damien Thorne I just found to be terrifying.
And Drew looked just like him as a kid.
That was a spitting image, too.
Did you have the little Damien haircut?
I did. I didn't realize how much I looked like him, but my mom later admitted, once I was an adult, that she was terrified of me for a couple of years.
She thought you looked fine. She did.
Omen 2, I got to say, it's one of the sequels that really is as good as the original.
It really is good.
It's so good.
The scene where he's in the military academy and the teacher starts harassing him and he just starts fucking rattling off all those dates.
Oh, it's amazing.
It's so great.
Or the ice, the kid trapped under the ice.
That scene's epic. Great.
Yeah.
And just him, like, you know, the self-identity, you know, it's such a perfect, like, you know, kind of puberty movie. Like, the self-identity of, like, oh my God, am I the devil? And
yeah,
do
like
I just
coming
accept
of
that
age.
You know, like
coming of
do
age.
I just
coming
accept
age.
That I've been having these weird dreams. Now everyone gets those. I don't know if everyone gets these.
Are weirder than most. I think
I killed a boy with my brain, you know.
Yeah. I didn't just get a weird boner, like like I control dogs. Do you guys get that? It's Damon talking to the guidance counselor. So you know how when you go through puberty and you control Dobermans? Wait, what?
You guys don't do that?
That'd be such a fun sketch. Yeah, Omen was spectacular. I mean, my favorite growing up was probably like Poltergeist. Poltergeist was great. Poltergeist, I don't entirely doesn't hold up for me, though. I saw it not that long ago. I think it was more because of the effects.
That third act where they're all popping up and stuff, it gets a little...
But some
of the blocking in that is pretty fantastic.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, no, it's Phantasm. Phantasm is a movie that fucked me up so bad when I was...
Good one.
So bad when I was a kid. I just had nightmares of the tall man. Nice. And then those like dwarf aliens like being squashed down.
That's a good one.
So good, so good. What were you guys? How far apart in age? You were 4 years apart.
No,
year and a half.
Year and a half.
I thought okay. So you must have taken time off and then finished school.
He was 2 years ahead of me. So he finished school and basically moved directly out to LA.
Yeah, he went to go be an investment banker.
That's my dirty little secret. I spent a little time on
what
Wall Street.
He was balling. Like I was like this poor like writer living in LA, like you know, eating dog food, and he was flying to like St. Bart's with girls and living in a penthouse. Like I mean, he was my little brother. My dad would be like, why can't you be more like your little brother? He's making a great living.
Oh, you mean Damien?
Damien. Totally
sold his soul. No, when I told our parents that I was quitting my job and moving to LA to work with John, my dad immediately called John and said, what'd he say?
He's like, you leave him alone. He's got a good job. You can't ruin everyone in the family. You know,
don't drag him into your horror sketches.
Exactly. And but it was nice. You know, when Drew came out, Drew was like, if we're doing this work, we should be paid for it. And that's such an alien concept when, you know, you start in, you know, arts and writing and stuff. And it's like, no one's paying me and I do it anyway. And that was helpful to have someone like, no, we this should be a job. You know,
you should get paid for your job.
Yeah,
we weren't very successful getting paid for a while, but it was a good idea.
It took a long time, but
well, there is a certain. I mean, like, it's in the beginning. It's good just to work however you can. Start work for free. Do whatever you can. Learn, and at a certain point, you're like, I think I might need to get paid. I feel like because there is the trap where once you start saying yes to stuff, then everyone's like, hey, will you do my thing? Will you do my thing? Will you do my thing? And of course you want to do all of it, but you can't do everything.
Yeah.
And because, especially because you understand that you need people to, when you're helping people, you also need people to help you make your thing at the same time. So how do you sort of balance out? Like at a certain point you want to say yes to everything, but you can't because then it starts to hinder your own development.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you're doing your own films, too, I mean, you have a mentality that you have to pay the whole crew, you have to pay actors, you have to pay everybody at least something, but we're the only ones not getting paid. And, like, you do a few of those, and it's, you know, you just can't live that way.
Yeah.
I worked in if someone's ever shooting a short film or a movie and they need people to work for free, the people will do it, but just a tip is get really good catering and craft service. Like if you feed people really well,
you're absolutely right.
They will actually feel like I worked on something with this friend of mine once, and it was a short film, and no one was getting paid. But she had someone there like baking and making food constantly, and there was like amazing lasagna and all these desserts and everything. And it completely, like, whenever I go work on something that's low budget, and it's just, you know, like, oh, I brought a bag of Oreos or something. It's like, oh, just if you're going to invest a little bit of money, because basically what you're investing is the spirit of the crew, which is very important. You know, you're investing in their happiness, and you're also saying, like, I appreciate that you're here, and I know I can't pay you, but I can at least give you good food. Like, that's something. Yeah. It's something tangible.
Yeah,
that's,
no, you're absolutely right. That is critical. I remember when we were doing Poughkeepsie tapes, you know, it was very low budge. We were very thinly spread, so I was producing it, but I was also, you know, handling craft services and everything. And I heard more complaints in the first week about Crafty than anything else. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, this is somewhere we need to step it up.
Because, well, that's when you're working all day. Like, that's the one place where you get little moments of joy, you know? If you're working like 12, 13 hours, you're like, oh, I could just go over there and, oh, man, it's the fucking carrot tray from Gelson's. And there's no ranch dressing left. I was at a thing a couple days ago, and it was, they just had, like, chopped up bell peppers. Like, who eats bell peppers? Just the red bell pepper slices.
I will say, the French really know how to do catering.
Yeah,
like,
I would
holy
imagine.
Crap. They it's like a 4-star restaurant every day at lunch. It's amazing. They actually required by union law to serve a glass of wine to everyone on the crew at lunch, which seems
every day
crazy here from a liability standpoint.
And then we show up and our actors start getting drunk at lunch.
Day two, like, okay, we got to kill this. American actors are just wasted after lunch. Like, okay, this is obviously the Americans are not responsible enough to handle this.
No.
But they're police. They're police. They unionized, they like picketed because they wanted two glasses of wine at lunch every day, which is perfect. You know, and police, you know, having a couple glasses of wine at lunch, you know.
I feel like we would quickly bastardize that law and be like,
for sure,
the government mandates you do a shot, pussy. What? I'm a cop. I'm a cop in this bit. Drink. Government said so. Do you like? Do you prefer shooting overseas, or what? And how is it different than if you were? I mean, it's probably is it tough to shoot in Los Angeles, or are they making it easier?
No, it's pretty great. Like great Los Angeles, LA, the people are great here, you know. But shooting abroad, there's something about like everything is so different that you know you have such a a clear perspective of it. I feel like
I love shooting out of town just because you kind of really leave your life behind and you commit to the movie and. You know, your friends aren't wondering why you didn't make it to their birthday party and why you didn't do this or that. You know, you really like, hey, I'm in Thailand. Sorry, I missed everything. You know, it's
yeah, people get it. Yeah.
People get it. And they just kind of let you go for 4 or 5 months and then you re-enter. And that's.
And it's a little like camp. Like, you know, you're there with a bunch of people and everyone's gone and it's, I don't know, it's fun and weird and everyone sort of has a timeout on life and you get very close with people.
Perfect amount of time to really kind of have a new home, but you don't have to fully commit to it. It's, you know, 4 or 5 months is like you really get to learn a country.
You start writing movies based around where you want to go. This is a horror movie that takes place at the Princeville Resort in Kauai. And we're going to have to be there for about
We've been trying to think of something like that. It just doesn't lend itself well. You know, it seems to be like, we were in Paris for the summer, but we were like in the sewers. You know what I mean? Like, and then we were in Thailand in the heat. And that was actually pretty
Thailand was awesome, though. Yeah. But we keep trying to find our Hawaii project. That would be great.
It's not good. I don't think it's
St. Bart's thriller.
Yeah.
You know, you're stuck on St. Bart's.
Supermodel zombie movie in St. Bart's.
And the Netflix would categorize that as like vacation resort thrillers. Like there'd be some real specific thing that movie would actually have to be. I don't, I haven't been to Paris in years, but it's so wonderful to feel so much history crammed into one tiny little area.
Oh, it's so beautiful. It was cool too. Like, you know, I'd be walking, you know, I brought my kids with me and walking down the street and going like, when my grandfather was here in World War II, it looked exactly the same. And my great, 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 great grandkids, when they come here, you know, 500 years from now, it's going to look exactly the same. And,
no, zombie apocalypse.
Yeah, yeah. You know, filled with zombies, but the buildings will be the same.
Zombies or robots. Zombie or robot apocalypse. It's going to be one of the two. Or maybe the robot apocalypse comes because the zombie apocalypse starts, and so we build robots to try to... It's sort of like the Matrix, like, oh, we blocked out the sun, and then they started using us as batteries. You know, like, we're going to have a hand trying to stop the apocalypse, but then we're just going to make it worse because we're fucking humans, and that's what we do.
That's exactly what we do.
When did you guys first start? I assume you were making films before you got him out of the investment banking game?
Yeah, we were always sort of... tied at that, like, you know, when I was, I think, 14, you were 12, I started writing, but then we shared a room, and then I'd show him what I was writing, and he'd start, and saying, oh, why don't you move this over here and try, repeating this, and so we started kind of collaborating at a really young age, and so we had always wanted to work together. I don't think this looked like a viable, a good life decision at first to him. And
it took a little bit of, I'm a little bit more of that kind of, practical type. And so I didn't, you grew up in Minnesota, making movies for a living doesn't feel like real life sometimes, I think. It took a little.
Now it does, but maybe not in the 90s. But it was harder to, I remember that. I remember when it was hard to just go make a movie. Like, okay, well, I guess we get 16mm film and we'll just run around and shoot it. And then, I don't know, I guess we'll submit it to a festival or two, or what happens?
But back then there was only a couple festivals. You know, there was kind of Sundance and Cannes and,
If you didn't get into those, you kind of just shelved it. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of options. So, our first movie together was called The Dry Spell, and that was, the festival world was exploding. It was, early days of digital, so we shot it digitally, and we found a way to make a movie for $35,000. So our first movie was just tiny.
Yeah, that craft services, we had a bag of chips in the trunk. That was our craft service. We were like,
I don't know if there's any left. They've been open for a while. They're in the trunk if you want them. Yeah,
that was sort of miserable, but people had fun.
Then is it strange to actually get money to make a movie when you're, the first time you actually get money? Like, what do we do?
It was weird. I gotta say, we kind of paid ourselves a little bit on Poughkeepsie Tapes, which is like us paying ourselves, a tiny amount. But
then on quarantine,
that didn't feel real. Like when we got a check from Sony on quarantine, that was like, oh my god, someone's.
Well, that and the fact that the money wasn't with the Dry Spell and Poughkeepsie Tapes, we were constantly like, okay. We'll give you all checks, but don't cash them until next week.
We swear to be good.
And Drew would be
there's
like
a lot of that. Yeah.
I remember you went skiing and you kept getting the extra service. Actually gave Drew's cell number to all the extras because we were late on that. So they're all.
I was getting death threats. I mean, I literally told everyone it was going to be 1 week late, and of course, I'm sure they hear that all the time, and it's never true. And in our case, it was true. We were very much going to pay them, but I was waiting on an investor check or whatever. And I took a little post-wrap ski vacation, and I was getting 100 calls a day from, I don't know if you ever worked with non-union extras too. They're a motley bunch.
By the way,
it's
you were on ski vacation.
I know.
Sorry, I can't pay you. Let me just hit these slopes, and when I get to the bottom of the hill, we'll see what's going on with that chick. Two more rounds of drinks, and... Oh, are you still on the phone? Shit. Just hang on.
I recognize the irony.
You're ruining my ski vacation.
Your need to eat is ruining my good time.
Well, it was $50 a person, too. I'm clearly, you're not missing your rent check, I hope, based on my $50.
Well, it's funny to me that a movie, I don't know what other business, I can't really think of another example where a movie costs essentially whatever you have to make it. It's either going to cost $35,000 or if someone gives you $100 million, you'll figure out how to spend $100 million on the same story.
Well, no, it's true. It's true. But I mean, when you're doing it in that zone, doing your own films on that same ski vacation, I also had about $97,000 on my Amex. That was, you live with is like...
Oh, so you're like, what's another grand?
Oh my God. I mean, that was not something I could afford by any means. It was just bridging the movie just to keep it alive and waiting for money to come in. I mean, you live with this just incredible amount of stress that you're going to be ruined.
And then on quarantine when, you know, it was paid for by the state, like... To not worry about money, like, in the same way, like, not worry about, like, oh, my God, we're out of money. Like, we can't let anyone know, like, how do we keep this going, you know, and finish the movie, and can we finish it? Like, to not have that part of the job, it was like, oh, wow, we can focus on making a film and not, you know, spend half the day trying to figure out,
you know, house of cards that you're trying to keep intact. I mean, it really, it frees you up tremendously.
Or like the show House of Cards, which had like millions of dollars per episode to make a television show. Yeah. Do you guys ever want to, no, so with the types of films that you make, has it ever occurred to you like, oh, we should take these stories and expand them and do, and you know, like do a television series, like do a series? Or do you just like the process of, do you like telling stories in like, you know, 90 to 120 minutes?
You know, I really love that the 90 to 120 minutes, like that zone feels really good. You know, we'd love to do something in TV, just, you know, the chance to really explore a character and really dig in and develop something over time. I think it would be really fun. We haven't quite found the right thing yet.
Yeah, that would be really fun. It's really, getting a TV show made is really difficult, as I'm sure you know. And it's, you know, the process of pitching it and, you know, getting a pilot greenlit and then getting a series picked up. I mean, there's just so many levels of acceptance you need to get to have a show really go. Whereas, you know, a film is hard to get made, but, you know, it's all in one script. It's either going to get greenlit or not, or you're going to get financed or not. And it makes more sense to us, I think.
How's the notes process go in film? Is it like script read? Obviously, you know, do a table read, you'll probably get notes, and you'll do another draft, and then you'll probably get notes. But then as you're shooting, are they still coming in and giving you notes? Or I assume you're getting notes as they're seeing dailies, or do you get left alone?
It really depends on the movie, I guess.
Yeah, it depends on the movie. Like, you know, quarantine, the studio is very involved, you know, and whereas, you know, these last couple, you know, they've it's been as really above, nice. Yeah. As Above and The Coup, like, we sort of got to do our own thing. On The Coup, we were in Thailand. There was no producers there. There was, you know, I think David Lancaster was watching dailies, but more like, great, looks great, you know.
Or just thumbs up. And we got lucky on that one in that we were with a great financier that trusted us a lot, but they also had, you know, they were having an explosion of other projects going on, so they're very thinly spread, which, you know, was good for us. And and with Legendary, they, you know, it was a small movie for them. They had, you know, Godzilla, and they had, you know, Pacific Rim, so our little movie was kind of under the radar a little bit.
Yeah. So they also have this company called Nerdist, which you know, it costs $1 billion a year to run. So they really, you know, they really have to focus in. Yeah. So I'm sorry if we took
some of their attention
dollars away from you, like we were on a ski vacation, and you guys
and we couldn't pay our rent. $54.
Let them eat snow. I'll mail them some from atop my castle. You're on this alpine hill. What is it about horror that you like? Why, besides the fact that you're fans of horror, like what specifically is fun about that type of storytelling?
Yeah, it's fun to see people at their limits. You know, there's such drama, and there's such, you know, to see people in crisis, you really learn so much about people and how they react. Like, I don't know, I find that such a fascinating part of life, and it's fun to explore that in films.
Yeah, it's fun. I think people put themselves in the character's shoes a lot in horrors or thrillers of, you know, what would you do in this crisis? How would you react? And just to see the visible reaction of audiences when watching your movie is really, you know, I'm sure it's similar for comedy, seeing people, you know, connect and laugh at your movie, you know, hopefully.
It is, but it's hard. But, you know, the more, and horror's sort of the same way. It's sort of, horror relies on a little bit of magic trick the same way comedy does, which is you have to surprise your audience. And so how do you, when so many things have been, like every time another thing gets made, that's another way that was done. And so you're painted more and more into a corner of like, well, how do we surprise audiences, or how do we present these ideas to them and, or shock or scare them in ways that, you know, they don't go, ah, yeah, saw that coming. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, of course. Oh, now this part, you know, where the audience basically just turns into, you know, Scream, where they're narrating it essentially. along with the movie.
Yeah, I think sort of the key is character. Like, if you really believe the characters, you're really, you know, in it with them, I think then you'll, you know, you're more on the ride than, you know. And I think often, like, horror films especially don't take the time to really dig into character. And I think that helps a lot.
Well, do you ever, is there another genre that you guys want to play around with?
Yeah, with our next film, The Coup, which is coming out in March, we go more into, it's more of a survival tale. It's like a thriller. It's more in that space. So mm-hmm. It's still, you know, someone in crisis. It's still kind of a crisis movie, but it's not horror. It's more thriller.
You guys seem like nice, polite, well-adjusted young men.
Well, thank you.
Horror people tend to be pretty normal, I think.
Yeah, horror
they really are actually
pretty sweet people generally. Yeah.
They really, really, really are. And I wonder why.
It's the comedy people who get a little wackaloo.
Oh, the comedy people. Well, right? First of all, the fact that you just said wackaloo means that you should be directing horror movies because you're ultra normal. That's a very. Is that. A, comedy people are way more fucked up than horror people.
They are. They totally are.
I wonder why that is. I guess maybe. You know, maybe horror people sort of recognize, like, oh, yeah, none of this isn't real, but. You know, and also there is a kind of a layer of separation because you're creating a fantasy world, whereas mm-hmm. comedy people are really dealing with fucking issues. Yeah. And that's where comedy's coming from.
I think so. I think, you know, I've noticed, like, with writing, I write darker stuff when I'm feeling really good and, like, lighter stuff when I'm feeling really dark. I think there's a little bit of a release, like a pressure valve that... If you're feeling dark all the time, you need comedy to, you know, to lighten it up. Whereas,
yeah, there's a lot of days on set on horror films too that just feel like being a kid. You know, you get to play with blood and, like, gore and things like that. Like, everybody just gets, you know, their inner child comes out a lot. It's I don't know.
What's your favorite type of effect? Or what's your favorite way to kill someone in a movie?
Ooh. Ooh. Quarantine. Stacy.
Oh yeah. Killing, you know, it was a, you know, quarantine was a, like, found footage thing. We actually killed my wife with the lens of the camera. So smashed her face in and with the lens of the camera. And yeah, we kill her in every movie. And that's kind of our running gag.
But that one was, that one was the best. Yeah.
And she, of course, she's cool with this, right?
Oh, she loves it.
It's a weird badge of honor to, I mean, I know as a performer, you're like, oh, I want to survive till the end because then I have more scenes. But I've done a horror movie, and it's such a badge of honor to get killed really hard in a horror movie.
For sure.
Yeah.
And everybody you know who, you know, people that are not actors or extras by trade, but everyone, of course, wants to be an extra in a movie, and everybody wants to be a corpse. Everybody.
Yeah. Really?
Like, people you would never expect, you know,
and
like...
And they all want to be naked.
They all want,
like,
to be naked.
If you need me to be naked, that's okay. You're like, I'll do that. Like, people, you'd be like, dude, I don't want to see you naked.
Dad, no one wants to see you naked.
Dad, nobody
thanks,
wants to
Wilford
see you
Brimley.
Naked. Yeah, exactly. It's like...
Totally
the wrong people. Not nobody you'd ever want to see naked, but like, if you need a corpse, I'm happy to do it, and I'll get naked even. Like, no.
Thanks, though.
I want me to get naked and dead? Why would you have to be naked? Like, why couldn't you just be dead?
I don't know. I think it's a weird thing.
We've gotten that offer.
Cut, put your pants back on. Oh.
We've gotten that offer more times than you can imagine.
I got really hot, and then I died. Took off all my clothes, and then... What's the problem? The problem is I can see your dick in the shot. Now I can never not see that. It's burned. You just see the, it's like if you stare at a hot light, and you just see, like, there's just like a purple dong imprint in my field of vision forever. It's I always horror is, I think, so helped by the fact that you can. I mean, obviously, you can do super high techy effects, but just like watching people get creative with the type of, you know, that's why I think it's low budget sci-fi, I think, is a lot harder because you do need to have a believable element of, you know, like whatever the sci-fi gag is. Mm-hmm. But with horror, you can get, I think you can really get super creative with, like, let's mix this and this, and then we can create these wounds, or we can create this effect, or like, I think mm-hmm. it forces, and with budgetary constraints, I think it forces people to have to be more creative, and that ultimately raises the genre if you can do it right.
It's true, and you can get, like, super, like, artsy and weirdo in horror in a way that you couldn't in any other genre without it tipping into, like, like, okay, that's weird, or that's too artsy. You know, with horror, you can really sort of do whatever. I mean, as long as it fits the parameters you've set in the film.
Yeah. Do you like to watch the test screenings? You like to watch, are you watching the audience or are you watching the movie?
The audience. It's one part feeling the energy in the room and feeling like, okay, I'm seeing a lot of people shuffling or drinking water now, or, you know, it's you sort of watch the body language and feeling the energy. Like, you can feel it when everyone's, you know, tapped in.
Yeah. You learn a lot from those screenings. We had on our first movie was a comedy, actually. And then we made the Poughkeepsie Tapes, which is about a serial killer. And of course, we invited all these festival people that knew us from our first movie to the test screening. And we had a couple moments up top of the movie originally that were kind of funny. There were, you know, kind of funny characters that we interview. And then we, like, kill a 7-year-old, you know, 8 minutes into the movie. one of the first cards I read said, I didn't think it was very funny to, you know, killing kids isn't very funny or something like that. You know, we realized a lot of people came into the movie thinking it was a comedy, and we're like, okay, we need to scrap, you know, anything that's even remotely funny.
Yeah, we need to change the score and take out some funny things.
In your head, you know where it's going.
Yeah.
But you forget sometimes, like, the audience doesn't know.
Yeah, it's like a nervous laughter. Everyone was sort of like, was that supposed to be funny?
Yeah.
We lost some friends that day.
Yeah.
We did. We really did.
Now, did you, how many kids do you have?
Two.
Do you have kids?
I don't have any kids, no.
So, did you get weirder about murdering people once you had kids? Because sometimes people will get a little more squeamish once they have children.
You know, it's funny. Like, you know, I'd always worry. Like, you see all these comedians, like, suddenly become not funny when they have kids. I was like, oh, I hope I don't get soft, you know, when I have kids. And so, I tried very hard to, you know, and it turns out, you know, it didn't soften me up. But I definitely had to focus on turning off that side of my creative brain when I was at home, you know, like imagining the kids dead and like, what if you strangled it? You know, I had to be like, okay, stop doing that. Like, you know, this isn't healthy. You know, that stressed me out, but I think he didn't change
at all. I was a little worried about that too. Cause you know, our Thailand movie, The Coup, is about, you know, a family with two young daughters and, you know, in massive peril. You know, that was written before John had kids, and I wondered sometimes, like, would we still write something like that now? But it's really pretty unchanged. It helps that John's wife is as twisted as he is.
Yeah, she is.
Now, that means, are your kids going to turn out, like, are you going to be upset if your kids are like, we don't like horror, Dad? Like, what are you talking about?
Well, actually, Henry, it was funny. We just did a press thing in Paris, and we dumped the kids, let the kids stay with my mom.
We just left the kids in the catacombs, just let them run around.
And Henry came back, and he's like, I watched the most amazing movie. Sharks get sucked up into the sky and then fall all over. And he's 5 years old. This kid's 5 years old. He's like, and then they're eating people.
Sharknado,
and I was like,
the magic
I'm like,
of Sharknado.
And he's like, yeah, that's it. And I was like, I don't think you should be watching that. You're five. And he's like, it's fine, Dad. You know, so, I mean, he's down for it. But Maggie, my 2-year-old, is not into, she hates our trailers.
I bet if you're five, Sharknado is fucking mind-bending.
Amazing.
I mean,
the best movie ever.
What? Yeah. Because in your mind, that could happen if you're five. Why couldn't it happen?
Totally.
And the effects look perfect.
If a tornado just sucked up a bunch of sharks, that's exactly what would happen. I mean, it's totally... I mean, we watch it ironically, but to a five-year-old, it's like, this is science.
Yeah, totally.
Like, this is a documentary. This is what could happen.
Yeah, man, it's fun to see. Like, magic happens in his world. Like, magic... Like, he asked me if, like, when you listen to a shell, if you can hear the ocean, because there's a magical invisible wire that connects the two. I'm like, that's awesome. That's awesome that is the best
and
explanation.
Yes, that's the reason. That's what it is.
And tornadoes suck up sharks, and you know, it's pretty awesome.
Do you think you'll get to a point where you're like, hey kiddo, what do you think of this idea? You know, have you started to mine him for information about?
Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah. Yeah. I do that. I pitch stuff to him and he gives me a thumbs up or thumbs down. He's at that age, though. He'll always have a better idea. So I'll pitch something to him, and he'll be like, no, no, no. What you need to do is this. And then he'll start pacing back and forth. It's like a little version of me, and I just annoy the shit out of myself.
I wonder what would happen. I mean, obviously, I'm sure it wouldn't work. But wouldn't it be fun just for a month just to let like a rambunctious kid pick what movies are going to get made and just see what happens.
You know, it probably wouldn't be much different.
These are ideas. Like,
I bet it'd be better than...
It's like a TV set. Do you remember that movie, TV set?
Yeah.
Where Sigourney Weaver always like goes to her like 11-year-old daughter, and she basically makes the decision to greenlight shows or not. Like, I feel like it's kind of like that.
I feel like that there's a crazy billionaire somewhere that needs to just do these types of social experiments,
yeah,
just to see what happens.
You know, so often it's like these corporate entities. Like, I trust a kid's judgment better than that. You know. More than the numbers of things.
Yeah, because you know? a kid isn't chasing a trend, or they're not trying to... They don't care about what they think other people will like. They just know what they like.
Yeah, that's true.
And they only like stuff that they think is awesome. And if they don't think it's awesome, they have no interest whatsoever. I mean, I feel like it's a pretty pass or fail kind of a...
That's true.
Kind of a test.
Yeah.
Because I know that when they were... you know, when they were, you know, scientifically building Sesame Street, and they would... put these kids in a room, and they know immediately what kids don't like because they just lose interest.
Yeah.
That's how they, you know, that's how they know, like, oh, okay. And then they learn by doing this and by doing that. Like, you know, they're a perfect test audience.
Mm-hmm.
They are.
Maybe not for the types of movies that
could be a lot of like buddies movies, like the little golden retriever movies, like, you know, be a whole lot of golden retriever movies, you know,
and then it just turns into like a slasher flick, like one of the dogs goes crazy.
What do you think of this movie, kid? It's a golden retriever getting its throat cut.
Yeah. It's like Milo and Otis meets Hostel. What?
The kennel.
Do you want to pitch that just to see what the executive was like? Wait, what? Yeah, yeah.
Like Kill Shelter.
Oh.
There you go.
I mean.
There you go. It makes itself.
Right there. No, because you know what? The problem is that people could watch other people get killed a million times, but animals, I just can't.
No, that's like a cardinal sin.
It makes me so sad.
Can't kill a dog.
Yeah. I'm waiting for someone to give the ice bucket challenge to their dog and see like how people react to that.
Well, I can't even watch like when animals get needy in a movie. Like I get so upset. Or even like, you know, there's a scene in Lost where Walt's being taken away and the dog jumps in and starts swimming after them. And it just unhinged me. Like, yeah. Oh, the dog's trying to help and he wants to, God damn it. Like animals trying to do stuff.
Yeah, it's true.
It's animals, a huge bummer to me.
Yeah.
Animals too. On set, I remember reading an Ethan Coen quote about Raising Arizona. He's like, you know, the dogs, like you have, you know, all these handlers and you have all these restrictions and everything.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
These babies, we can just do whatever we want. It's the animals you gotta really pay attention to.
That's, do you ever, when you look at Raising Arizona, do you ever go, I want to make a movie like that? Or do you go, you know, that's just not, that's unachievable because that's just so what they do.
It's pretty awesome.
It's so what they do. I mean, it would be great to make a movie in that.
Yeah, we'd love to do a comedy at some point of that ilk. Yeah.
But how do you tackle that sort of surreal kind of comedy that is somehow really far out, but somehow grounded at the same time?
Yeah, that'd be so hard. It's such a difficult tonal thing to, you know, tonal tightrope to walk. Like, and they do it so well. It would be so hard to.
I mean, they're so good. So great at character, and they're so great at casting too. I mean, you have to get just exceptional actors in those kind of movies.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a certain budget range that you think, I don't know if I ever want to make a $200 million movie? Like, would you like the pressure of that? Or do you think like, no, I think I'd rather, because there's something nice about having some restrictions.
There's something nice about not having to appeal to absolutely everyone in the world. You know,
right.
If you make a $200 million movie, everyone in the world has to like it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, little kids and old women, you know, like everyone has to like it.
And you have an entire studio all over you when you're making it. I think that would be, I don't know, that'd be a less pleasant filmmaking experience, I think.
Yeah. We like sort of doing our own kind of homemade, you know, kind of, you know, family shop kind of thing. And it's really nice having some freedom, not worrying that everyone in the world has to like it. Just some people have to really like it.
Right.
And I don't know, that I feel like you can get more specific and more do stuff that means more to us, you know.
Yeah, our agent keeps telling us, like, you guys don't want to, you know, make $20 million movies the whole, you know, the rest of your career, do you? It's like, well,
yeah,
that's actually sort of sounds awesome. Kind of awesome, you know? Like, yeah. You know, I could see doing a big one if it was ours and it was something we really felt connected to, but, you know, that's a 2 or 3 year commitment. And when those don't go well, you know.
And horror is one of those genres where you really can, you could make a $3 million movie and it could open at number one and, you know, make $60 million the first weekend.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
It's somehow horror is a genre that can fast track directors or you know, and I wonder why. I can never figure out like what it is specifically about horror that allows people to, you know, that that a low budget movie could all of a sudden just open at that level.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm surprised that comedies don't have that, like. Because I think, like, well, if something scares you, it scares you. And people show up to that. If it has a good concept, they'll show up. But with comedies, too, like, I would think that would translate to comedies as well. Because the two are really
forgiving.
Similar.
They're similar, but people are less forgiving with comedy. Yeah. And, you know, there's only – and there – you know, I think there are a million ways to tackle a joke that can miss.
Yeah.
And only
a
couple right ways to do it. But with horror, there, you know, it's like – there are a handful of general things that just scare the shit out of everyone.
Yeah. And you can do so much more with filmmaking in horror than in, you know, in comedy, like the actor has to be on that day and nail it or it doesn't work. There's nothing you can do as a filmmaker, very little you can do as a filmmaker to change the edit or, you know, it has to be, you know, the actor. Whereas, you know, you can do so much, you know, like, you goose the sound in horror. You do a slow push in or whatever you do.
You can just go throw some more blood on that joke. And it'll be fine. Yeah, there's so many ways to fuck up a comedy. Your lighting can fuck up a comedy. Your shot can fuck it up. The score can fuck it up. The actor can fuck it up. Like, there's the other actors can fuck up. Like, there's so many different ways for a comedy to not work.
It's true.
That it's actually surprising that it works as much as it does.
Yeah,
that's true. But I agree with you, though. I wouldn't think comedy would be so star-driven. You know, like, you know, genre films can break out and, you know, there's countless examples. But you look back in the last 20 years in comedy, it's really, you know, Napoleon Dynamite and Clerks are really the two kind of like out of nowhere, you know, successes in comedy. And that you wouldn't think it's so star-driven, but it really is.
Well, I think it's sort of – I think people are more driven – I think they're more driven by fear. I mean, you know, like that rush than they are the ha ha ha. Like something has to be so fucking funny.
Yeah.
That you can't, I mean, you know, before Borat hit like critical mass, I mean, I saw a test screening of it and no one had you weren't really familiar with the character yet. And it was so, I mean, people were falling out of seats. And so you just knew
that movie
people are going to talk about this and this. But the level that a movie has to achieve as a comedy in order to get that kind of, you know, you have to see this fucking movie.
Yeah.
But a horror movie, you can be like, oh, fuck. I almost shit my pants. I got to tell everyone, you know, like it's just a different, I feel like it's easier to motivate people.
You're right.
By scaring the crap out of them than to, you know, than trying to guess. Because what's funny to people is so specific.
Yeah.
And most people are not going to agree on what's funny, but more people will agree on what is scary.
Yeah, I think you're right.
That's true. And it becomes almost like a dare. You know, you know, this movie was so scary, you got to go see it because, you know, it almost becomes a dare. Like, oh, you know, I'm brave enough to do this too. Whereas a comedy, you just don't quite get that as well.
Yeah.
Did any of the actors, I feel like if I were shooting in the catacombs, if you took me like six stories down, I'd start to get real claustrophobic.
One of them, yes. You know, we did what we were calling a wardrobe test. We're like, let's make sure nobody's going to freak out down there. And so we did this like wardrobe test like 2 days before shooting, and we realized one of the actors didn't like being down there much. He was obviously uncomfortable. And like 2 days later, we had him a scene where he's like stuck in this section, and he's stuck on these bones, and he can't move.
It's the most claustrophobic scene in the whole movie. Yeah. It was his scene, of course.
And he nailed, like, it was so, like, he was so good at playing. I mean, we were six stories down. He's, like, literally jammed into this hole.
Use it.
And, yeah, totally. We used it. And he was so good. Like, all the other actors were like, oh shit, we're going to have to bring it if we're going to, you know, get up to that level.
No, I thought I was going to die. I really thought I was going to die.
Keep rolling, keep rolling.
Do you fuck with the actors at all to try to get more real performances out of them, or do you just trust the...
I wouldn't say fuck with them, but we do some things.
We do some things. We try, like, you know, there's a character, LaTope, who shows up halfway through the movie, and we intentionally set him up totally separately, so the cast never saw him until we were actually filming. We were down there, and he showed up in the take, and that's the first time they ever saw him. So their reactions to him are more real. We, you know, we do things like that, but it's not like we'll boat horn the actors mid scene, you know. That we've considered it. You know? Reaction. we actually did boat horn. There's a scene where they're on this church and we need all these, you know, the people of Paris, like the bells start ringing and everyone like looks up, you know, because these bells have never rung in, you know, 100 years. And they're like, well, we can't afford that many extras. I was like, just get me a boat horn. And we went up on this church in Paris, and we just boat horned, like, right off this.
John just emptied the whole can in one shot. It was,
and we got all these, you know, Parisians to look up. And
400 extras for free on that day. Yeah.
Most obnoxious American tourists ever.
This is what they do. They come over here with their boat horns.
It was so fun. It really was.
John was cackling like a kid. It was amazing.
Yeah. This is why we hate them. Would you like to send us a Bud Light up to you? I didn't experience like Parisian hate when I was over there. I thought they were actually very nice. They're very nice.
They're delightful.
Our French crew explained it. You know, Leo, our cinematographer, explained it to me once. He's like, "You think they're being rude to you, but you should see how they treat each other. Like how the Parisians treat each other is much, much worse." And so we take it personally, but I think it's just kind of a...
Well, I also, at the time I was there, my girlfriend at the time spoke French. And so I think she was given more respect. It's like, oh, you actually don't just speak your language and expect us to conform to you. You know, like they felt that she had made an effort. And so they were very respectful. They were very respectful. Yeah. I was just absorbing all the work that she had done.
That's the way to do it.
Drafting off of that? No.
It's the American way.
If you make even a poor attempt, it really goes a long way.
Where's McDonald's? Well, what are your next stops before? Are you pretty much done with all of the press stuff?
On the press stuff, we've got 5 or 6 more over the next couple of days, but we really had our big junket in Paris. That was the big one. And then Comic-Con, of course. And
yeah, so good.
Comic-Con was Comic-Con free.
It was great.
Awesome. It was, we did Hall H, which was
terrifying.
A new thing. And, you know, for about a month leading up to it, I was like, maybe I could be sick. maybe I don't have to do that.
Chobot hosted that, right?
Jessica, she did.
Yeah, that's
great.
She's great. Awesome. She's so cool.
She's awesome. We got to be on a panel with Guillermo and Michael Mann and Duncan Jones. It was really cool.
Nice.
Yeah, we had a good panel.
Yeah.
Well, I sincerely hope the movie does well.
Thanks so much.
And Coup comes out next year?
March 6th.
March 6th.
Wow.
2015. Yep.
That is a tight turnaround.
Yeah.
Yeah. We sort of made the two movies at the same time, which was... Yeah, that was something.
Yeah, we had a 7-week director's cut of As Above between Paris and Thailand. So it was tight.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
And then we did post on both simultaneously. And, you know, so it was a crazy year, but really an amazing and fun year.
So then you have another one in May, and then another one next September, and then another one.
God willing. Well, they, you know, the breaks will take themselves. You know, we'll just keep working as hard as we can. And
you're a couple of nice Minnesota boys. I hope everything goes well for you, so you can go back home to St. Paul and be like, "Suck my dick, fuckers! Fuck you and your guitar shops and your fucking."
A viral video of us riding the big cock and drunk downtown Minneapolis.
And you could just pay some drunk to dress up as Minnesota and then just be like, "Suck this dick," and he's like, "I don't know." Yep. Yeah, so I hope you guys get to do that.
That'd be amazing.
That'd be fun.
I'm sure everyone would appreciate that.
Thank you for being here, Daddles. Nice to see you.
Thank you so much,
everyone.
Thank you so much.
All right. The end.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.
Enjoy your burrito.